Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. For our reflection tonight, we are deeply honored to present Judge Thomas Bergenthal, who has devoted his life to international and human rights law. Judge Bergenthal is a survivor of Auschwitz, where he arrived at the age of 10. He was soon separated from his mother and then his father, and by some remarkable strokes of luck, truly remarkable, he managed to survive until he was liberated from Sachsenhausen in 1945, and almost 2 years after his liberation, he was miraculously reunited with his mother. He received law degrees from New York University Law School and Harvard Law, and is currently the American judge at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. He's the co-recipient of the 2008 Gruber Foundation International Justice Prize. His memoir, Lucky Child, A Lucky Child, a memoir of surviving Auschwitz as a young boy, is an extraordinary document, really a very beautiful book. Of course, anyone who is a Holocaust survivor has an extraordinary story to tell. Judge Bergenthal's story truly is a story of luck. He watches, learns, listens. He witnesses firing squads, hangings, beatings, and death by disease. This is a beautifully reflective piece of writing that celebrates the strength, courage, and wisdom of a child. It also explores the author's journey to become what he is today, an advocate for human rights worldwide. And I think Nick and Judge Bergenthal will explore some of these topics, that range. Nicholas Goldberg has been the editor of the op-ed page of the Los Angeles Times since 2003. Since 2007, he's also edited the paper's Sunday opinion section. He's a former Middle East bureau chief for Newsday, and in that position, he covered many major stories, including the peace process in Israel, the West Bank and Gaza, presidential elections in Iran, arms monitoring in Iraq, famine in Sudan, and civil war in Algeria. From 92 to 95, he was the paper's State House bureau chief, covering the administrations of Governors Mario Cuomo and George Pataki, and he also covered Bill Clinton's first presidential campaign. He's also a wonderful interviewer. Please welcome Nick Goldberg and Judge Thomas Bergenthal to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Hello. Can't quite see anybody out there. Thank you for coming tonight. I'm Nick Goldberg. We're very lucky to have Judge Bergenthal here tonight. He's, as Louise said, he's a law professor and a jurist, and he's worked on the World Court and on the Inter-American Court for Human Rights. He's done all kinds of extraordinary and wonderful things with his life, but today we're going to talk almost exclusively about things that happened to him before he was 11 years old. Judge Bergenthal was born in Czechoslovakia just the year after Hitler came to power in Germany, and his family fled to Poland, where he was not too long afterwards confined to the ghetto there. He was ultimately transported to Auschwitz. He left Auschwitz on one of the well-known death marches, and he, you know, was finally liberated, I think, in August of 1945. His story is a pretty extraordinary one, and there are two really powerful themes that come out in his book, in my view. One is this idea of luck and chance. The book is called A Lucky Child, and there's an awful lot in the book about being in the right place at the right time or being in the wrong place at the wrong time and how important those things become in a time of utter crisis like the one that the judge lived through as a young child. The second theme is that I got from it is that people respond to extraordinary situations in all kinds of different ways. Some people become beasts. Some people become cruel. Some people are survivors at any cost to other people. Some people become selfish, naturally, understandably, and some people do not give up their basic humanity. And there are stories in this book that really are stunning in both directions, that show people as utterly animalistic and show other people as stirringly human. And I hope we're going to talk about both of those things. And the last thing I want to say before we start is that, to me, it's important that we're hearing Judge Bergenthal, because to have a firsthand recollection of the Holocaust at this point, you have to have been at least 10 years old or 11 years old or 12 years old in 1945 when the war ended, which means that the absolute youngest you can be is Judge Bergenthal's age. You were born, I guess, in 1934. So you really have to be 74 or 75 years old to have any firsthand memories, which means that my children are going to hear very few firsthand memories of the Holocaust. And I think we should all be pleased and proud and moved and interested to hear someone come tell these stories that aren't going to be around for that much longer. So with that, let me get started. And what I'm going to do is ask the judge to tell us a little bit about his experiences in the beginning, and then we'll get to some of the broader thematic questions afterwards. So why don't you start, Judge, by telling us a little bit about the ghetto in Kielce. Did I say it correctly?
Correct. Perfect.
Okay. In the book, you describe it, and you describe its walls and fences and what it looked like and felt like. Why don't you tell us how you ended up in the ghetto and what day-to-day life was like?
Well, we were... I was born in Czechoslovakia, sort of historical accident, because both my mother and father decided in 1933 to leave Germany. And my father bought a small hotel in Czechoslovakia. Well, by 1938, he decided it was time to get out of Czechoslovakia and go to Poland. And we had been promised a visa to go to England in 1939. And we received the visa on September 1, 1939, when the Germans decided they kept following us from Czechoslovakia to Poland. And then in 1939, they decided to invade Poland. The British consul still tried to get us out through the Balkans, put us on a train. The train was bombed, and we ended up in a part of Poland which was very close to Kielce. And we had been told that there was a Jewish community, a large Jewish community in Kielce, so we just walked quite a number of days to get there. And within a short time, the ghetto started. Initially, sort of a primitive ghetto, they moved most of the Jews into the area of the city, a poor area of the city. And then gradually, the walls came and guards protected it. Then what would happen in the ghetto was, on the one hand, it was a quite normal life yet for people who weren't refugees, but the Germans would just come in, the SS and the police, and just randomly shoot people, pull people out of their houses. And at the same time, as a child, I had friends. We would play. There was one German who had the habit of just coming into the ghetto and walking and just shooting somebody. And so we children knew that, and there was just like a telegraph system in the ghetto. He's in the ghetto. And so we kids would know you disappeared. So life was sort of a strange life. On the one hand, normal for most of the people who sort of lived there. And for us, for refugees, it was quite difficult.
I liked the story about the box of tefillin you found. Why don't you tell that story?
Yes. Talking about what we children did, we found a tefillin, which is the philatelicos. What are they?
Phylacteries.
Phylacteries. And we had been told that if you opened it, God was going to strike you down. But if you managed to get the little parchment that was in it under your arms, you could fly. So we were debating long and hard, are we going to open it and fly? And what if God strikes us down right at that particular moment. Well, of course, our curiosity went out. We opened it and we looked up to see what was going to happen. And then we put it, the oldest among us, there were three of us, put it under his armpit and tried to take off. Nothing happened. And it went like this until it came to me. Nothing happened. And then we ran as fast as we could to get back home for fear that God would follow us.
The judge comes from a secular family, as I understand it, so secular that he, in the ghetto where you didn't have anyone who was not Jewish, there was no one to perform the function of the Shabbos Goy, which is the non-Jew who, you know, turns the lights on and off for religious people on Shabbat. So I believe you served as a Shabbos Goy.
I was the Shabbos Goy. And it was actually very useful because, for one thing, that way I could see how people lived and also would get some food. And we would often, my mother, father, and I would be invited to the Shabbos dinner because we had actually very little, but people were still living quite well. And for me, it was very unusual. I'd never seen really very religious Jews, the Hasidim. That was something I hadn't seen. And here, all of this life, which is unfortunately lost now, the Jewish culture of Eastern Europe was right there in the ghetto. Of course, it's all gone. But to me, it was, as a child, it was just an eye-opener to see all of this life.
But you also saw your first killings there. I assume there's a story about someone with white shoes.
Yes. When the ghetto was dissolved or liquidated, as the Germans would say, my father at the end ran a workshop that was doing things. Had tailors, shoemakers, furriers, and other people who had to perform work for Germans and for their wives. And my father saved a whole group of his workers. And on the evening when he came out of the workshop with us and the workers, we saw two Polish young men who had tried to rob, got into the ghetto and started stealing. The SS caught them, and when we got to them, we were beating them terribly and shot them. And it was, whenever I see white shoes, because this one young man was there on his knees trying to prevent the shooting from taking place, all I could remember was seeing this man with white shoes and being killed. It's quite and I was 8 years old at the time. That was sort of my first killing.
One of the really most moving stories in the whole book to me was the story of one ghetto inmate who had to be hung by another. Can you tell that story?
Yes, this was in a ghetto which sort of became, when the ghetto was liquidated, we were moved to a factory, to a work camp in Kielce. It's part of the ghetto. And a number of young men tried to escape. They were caught, beaten very badly, and then hanged. And we all had to stand there and watch the hanging. And the cruelty consisted of, by the SS, picking some of their friends to help them hang them. And one of the young men, I was, to this day I can still see it, because one of the young men had to put the noose over the head of his friend, and of course his hands were shaking, he couldn't do it. And the person who was to be hanged kissed his friend's hands and put his head through the noose and jumped off the chair in order not to give them the satisfaction of doing it. Those are the things that sort of stay with you.
And finally, about the ghetto, I wanted to just ask you about your friends Utsek and Zarenka, which you tell a very sad story in the book, and I know it's possibly difficult for you to talk about it, but if you're comfortable talking about it.
Yes, at one point in one of the smaller ghettos where we were moved to, they decided to take all of the children away, and eventually they took the children to the Jewish cemetery, and I'm told they killed them with hand grenades because the children were running away. But because of my father's work in the workshop, he was able to save my mother and me. And as we were walking in the direction of the place where we knew we were going to be saved rather than be sent to Treblinka, as my grandparents and others were, the two mothers of our neighbors just pushed the children, one boy and one girl, towards my mother, and my mother took them. And we had the children. They were sort of my younger brother and sister, which I never had. And they were then taken from us a year later. And one of the hardest things in writing this part of the story, that and the reunion with my mother were the two places where I had to stop before I could continue because of what I knew had happened. And my wife and I went to Kielce, but I couldn't, in 91, I couldn't get myself to go to the cemetery, to the Jewish cemetery.
So they ultimately liquidated the ghetto, and you were sent off. I believe you went briefly to a work camp, but ultimately you're sent to Auschwitz. This is now early to mid 1944. Can you tell us about the arrival at Auschwitz? What are the things that happened to you there? What do you remember? What does a 10-year-old boy see and feel?
But what was so striking about Auschwitz, we had heard rumors about Auschwitz, and one had heard rumors about Treblinka, and in Treblinka, basically, you arrived, and on arrival, everybody was executed. It was an extermination camp, basically. And so we thought the same thing was going to happen on arrival in Auschwitz. And I remember the morning when we arrived, looking out through the railroad cars, we saw people walking, working, and people said, "Well, there are human beings in Auschwitz, which means it can't be as bad as we thought it was." So just seeing people in Auschwitz was, in the work camp, was a surprise. But what happened then was, and I tell that I was lucky to get into Auschwitz, and people look at me and they say, "This man is totally crazy." And in fact, I was lucky to get into Auschwitz, because usually when you arrived in Auschwitz or Birkenau, which is the ramp, the railroad station, there would immediately be a selection, and children, old people, sick people would be taken away immediately to the gas chamber. But because we came from a work camp, they must have decided that there were probably no children anymore and no old people, and so there was no selection. I was separated from my mother, but I still stayed with my father, and entered the camp, and then came the usual thing, the tattoos, the cutting of the hair, the taking away all of your clothes, all of those things. But at least I was there in Auschwitz. Otherwise, I would have, if there had been a selection, I would never have gotten in.
You talked about they give you your striped uniform, they tattoo you, they give you a yellow triangle. One of the things you described that's very haunting is the reddish-brown color of the sky, from the smoke from the crematoriums, and you say that was always there. And did people know? Did everyone know what went on in those crematoriums?
Oh yes, you couldn't. The stench and the smoke that came from the crematorium was such that there were no birds in Auschwitz during that period. No grass grew. When we went back, the first time we went back in May of again 91. I said to my wife, "Look, there's grass and there are birds." And in a sense, you then have this feeling that the grass is covering up what really happened in that terrible place. But it was so different. And you can imagine a May day with grass, birds, and everything in this terrible place, which was the water was the water that came out. We had a wash place where you could wash. It was a rusty water. The soil was always mud in the summer, and ice mud in the winter, all brown. The sky, terrible color sky always, and you could smell it. It was terrible, terrible. And you couldn't be any, even the furthest away from the crematorium, you would still be able to smell it. I was relatively close. I was first in the gypsy camp, which was the camp when we came, the gypsies, the whole thousands of gypsies, families, of whole families were killed in the gypsy camp just to make room. And that was relatively close to the crematorium.
When you were in the ghetto, you describe this strange contradiction that on the one hand people are being killed around you, at the same time you're a 9 or 10 year old boy. There's some normalcy. You're playing with your friends. Was that true at Auschwitz as well, or did that all go away?
No, that all went away. In Auschwitz, it was basically day in and day out, just to make sure that you had a little piece of bread, and that you weren't caught by the angel of death, Mengele, in the selection process. And there was no playing anymore. This was very, very serious, very dangerous, and a totally different life.
Was Mengele familiar to everybody? Did you recognize him? Did he stroll around the camp?
You know, I had this strange sense once I was asked to describe a guard in a trial in the U.S., and I realized that I never dared look at them. So I couldn't describe.
Make eye contact.
I couldn't make eye contact, but I could tell you that we knew when Mengele was in the camp, it again, telegraph. Mengele is in the camp. So recently there was a French magazine managed to get hold of some pictures that had been taken, and Mengele was on the picture. I wouldn't have recognized him.
Well, can you talk about the separation from your mother? So when you first came to Auschwitz, she was taken off to another place, and for a long time you didn't see her, and then there was one moment at the camp where you did see her. How did that come to pass?
This was... I was, of course, first separated from my mother, but was still together with my father. And then at one moment, I was separated from my father. My father was sent to another camp. And I ended up, there's a long story of how I got, but I ended up in what was known as a children's block in a different camp in Birkenau. And that our job there consisted of collecting garbage from the different camps. And at one moment, we were sent to a camp which was close to the women's camps, in Birkenau. And we somehow, there were two friends of mine who also came from Kielce, and we knew that the women were in that particular camp. I think it was C camp. In Birkenau. And so we started, as we were pushing our garbage wagon, we started yelling across the electric wire, and he tell the women from Kielce that we are here. Kielce was the town. And then some of them came out, and my mother was among them. It was the first time I saw my mother since the time when we were separated. A capo came, a woman capo on her side, and just dispersed them. So it was almost just a glimpse, and I didn't see her again until December of 1946. So that was 2.5 years after we were separated.
The camps were run by the SS, but these capos were inmates, weren't they?
They were inmates, and they were doing the dirty job for the... And there were a lot of Jews among them, some German criminals, some Poles. The Kapos, and these were usually people who'd come to the camp much earlier. They were there, the survivors from 1942. And to survive during that period as a Kapo meant that you had to help beat and kill fellow inmates.
What did they get in return?
They got the...
They survived.
They survived. And these were people, when I came to Auschwitz, there was somebody who had been a friend of ours. We were together refugees in Poland when we first, and he was a dentist or dental technician. And when we got to Auschwitz here, he was a capo and treated people accordingly.
So... I'm sorry to move quickly through this, but tell us a little bit. The camp is finally liquidated, and there's this death march out of Auschwitz as the Russian troops are coming towards it. Tell us what your experience was on the march.
Well, this was a 3-day march in January of 1945. If anyone here knows what the winter in Poland can be like. This was January 45, and we had hardly any clothes on. I had a little blanket on top of my prison garb. I went back on the anniversary of that date once with coats, jackets, and I was freezing. And here I survived it, except I lost some toes in the process. But it was 3 days march. We then ended up in a temporary camp in Upper Silesia, and from there it went a 10-day train ride to another camp in Germany, open railroad cars. Unbelievable. When we first got into the railroad car, I could hardly breathe because the tall people it was so tight. By the time we arrived and where we were going, there weren't more than 15 or 20 people who had survived. We had to throw the bodies out of the moving railroad car. That was, well.
One of the extraordinary stories that you tell about the march is that, in the middle of this 3-day-long march, the children start to get weak and they start to not be able to keep up with everyone else, and the SS basically kills all the children who were walking with you, but because you and a friend had happened to lag back and were not marching with the rest of the children at that moment, you escaped being killed, which is just one of the many extraordinary pieces of luck that comes out in your story.
Well, we decided that we were getting tired and it was cold, and so we thought, we had initially been put in, some of the children from the children block had been put on the front of the column, and children were slowing things down. So we decided that the way to rest was just to stop and let everybody pass us by. And then when we got to the end of the column, there were 10,000, we would run forward again. And during one of those stops, they decided to take all of the children out and said, we're going to put them into a monastery and they'll be safe. And we decided we didn't trust them, that they were going to go to a monastery. So we remained where we were, even though people were trying to push us out. Go, you'll be safe. But we had a lot of experience with that safety.
Well, and one of the story, I mean, just to go back to this other theme of little acts of kindness and little acts of cruelty, and one extraordinary story to me is the story of the cup of coffee on the train. Yes. Can you explain what happened there?
In these last 10 days when we were moving on to Germany, we had a SS guard that would be changed, who would be sitting. These were open railroad cars, you can imagine snow and ice, and he would sit in one of these cabins, and they would change. We didn't even know. And when we arrived at a freight railroad station in Berlin, he gets out, he climbs down, and comes back with a cup of coffee, the steam, and we were freezing, of course. I looked at that. I must have just tried to drink this from his cup. He hands me the cup of coffee and goes back to get himself another cup of coffee. At almost the same time, I hear a German woman who walks by there say, "Es stinkt schon wieder von Juden." It smells again, stinks again of Jews. So you have this juxtaposition of this stormtrooper giving me a cup of coffee and this civilian person reacting that way. It's something I've never been able to reconcile in my mind. How is that possible?
The other thing that happens on that train trip, I believe, is that the train taking you from Poland to Germany actually has to go, it has to go roundabout through Czechoslovakia because so many of the train tracks have been destroyed. And as you pass through Czechoslovakia, you go under a bridge and the Czech people are throwing loaves of bread down to feed the people in these open boxcars, which is another.
Yes, I survived because of that bread that came down. We must have come two or three bridges. And how the Czechs knew that the trains were coming through and had organized, obviously the resistance must have organized that, and the bread came down. The first loaf that my friends caught and told me to hold on to, it was stolen from me. We were so cold, I was sitting on it and it disappeared. But then we had, the bread saved me and many other people. It was just, when you think about it, manna from heaven. Here it came. And I should tell you about this event, because when I was asked, I used to be on the board of the Holocaust Museum in Washington, and I was asked on one of the anniversaries of the Death March to talk about it. And I, as I prepared my speech, I said, did this really happen, or am I imagining it? It, because, you know, this is a long time ago, and it's almost the parallel with manna from heaven and all of this. And eventually I decided, I know it happened. And I gave this speech, and there were some survivors, and they kept saying, I could hear people saying, yes, yes, we remember. So there are lots of those things where you no longer, after so many years, you don't really know whether it really happened or not.
So you tell these extraordinary stories about the SS officer who gives you the cup of coffee, which is such a small token gesture that it's insignificant, but somehow it's extraordinary. Or the Jew who is hanged in the ghetto and he kisses the hand of the guy who's hanging him, or the people who drop the bread. And then you ask this question: what is it that gives some people the moral strength not to sacrifice their decency and dignity, regardless of the cost to themselves, while others become murderously ruthless in the hope of ensuring their own survival? And this is the theme that just appears and reappears throughout the book. And you never quite answer that question, and I'm certain that I don't know the answer, but I thought I would give you an opportunity to try.
I wish I had the answer. And that's the reason why I keep asking the question in the hope that I would get the answer. I don't know the answer. And I wish we knew the answer to that, because if we did, we possibly could prevent some of the terrible things that we humans do to other humans. It's incomprehensible to me. People actually that one knows, ordinary people, suddenly begin to act. I don't want to say act like animals, because animals, that wouldn't be nice. But I don't know the answer. To me, that has been sort of the question that I cannot answer, perennial question that has, because as I wrote it, it reappeared. It kept following me. I don't know the answer.
When you finally came in on this train, you were taken for the rest of the war. You spent in Sachsenhausen, and there you met a man named Odd Nansen. Can you tell us a little bit of him? He's another one of these extraordinary people you ran across. Tell us how you met him. You were in the infirmary, I think, because of your amputated, frostbitten toes, and that's where you first met him.
Yes. You probably, let me first start out by saying something. You probably wonder, here is a concentration camp, and here I am as a child in an infirmary, and I get operated on. This is, again, the sort of, this was a camp where they actually had a very well-stacked hospital-like with doctors, inmates. And then when they cured you, you ended up very often being killed one way or the other. Usually, it's sort of, if you stayed more than 4 weeks, the chances were that you'll never get out of the infirmary. That's why I was also afraid to go to the infirmary. But I was there, and I had my toes amputated, the other legs, toes were also for the hands. One day, a Norwegian who was visiting another Norwegian, there were quite a number of Norwegians and Danes who, as political prisoners, who had opposed the Germans when they invaded their countries. And this one man came over to me, and it turned out that his name was Odd Nansen. He actually was one of the co-founders of UNICEF after the war. And the Norwegians and the Danes got food packages from Sweden, from the Swedish Red Cross. So he saw me, he started to talk to me, asked me where I came from. Then sort of every few days he would come and bring me cookies and things to eat. And then one day he came to me and said that we have to leave. I tried very hard to take you with us, but I wasn't allowed to. But here is my address in Norway, and you have to, after the war, we have to get together, and you have to write to me, and don't lose this piece of paper with my address and my name. Well, of course, I lost it. And what he had done was, not only did he bring me food, but he also gave cigarettes and tobacco to the orderlies of the room with the thing, save the boy and there'll be more coming. And the orderlies had to draw up lists of people. So he saved my life. And after the war, when I told my mother, there was this Norwegian whose father was very famous. He's the Odd Nansen, the son of Fridtjof Nansen, the person after whom who created the Nansen passport after the First World War. But I didn't know. I forgot the name, but he was a wonderful man, and his father was very famous, and his father's picture even appeared on a cookie jar. And my mother said, well, it must have been a cookie manufacturer. And then one day, she read in a newspaper that a Mr. Nansen had published a diary from the concentration camp of Sachsenhausen. And so she said, why don't you write to him? Maybe he knows the person who saved your life. So I wrote to him, but I, of course, had no address. And I didn't know whether he was the person who saved me. So I just simply wrote, Mr. Nansen, Norway. And nothing happened for about 6 weeks. And then the doorbell rang in Germany where we lived, and a Norwegian military truck arrived with a big, tremendous crate of food, including chocolate collected by school children in Norway for me. It turned out that I'd become famous in Norway. His diary, which he'd written in the camp, had some chapters dealing with me, and it was dedicated to me, among other people, assuming that I had not survived the war. And then there was a big excitement in Norway when they found out that I had survived. And we stayed in touch regularly. There is somebody here in the audience who was actually in a train with me when I returned from a visit to Nansen, and I was with his children very recently. But he was a wonderful man. He then wrote a book called Tommy after about 20 years later, again about my experiences, and it interviewed my mother, and it was a friendship. It was also the man who influenced my thinking about hate and reconciliation. Because when I first came to Germany, when I was reunited with my mother, I had this notion. I had wanted to be on a balcony. We had a balcony where the Germans on weekends would pass by, and my father had been executed and had not come back. And I wanted to do to them what they had done to us. And Mr. Nansen's entire life was based on the notion that hatred doesn't get you any place. He gave the proceeds from his book to German refugees, and by that time I was 14, 15, and started to think, why would he do this? And it had a tremendous impact on my own thinking about the need to put an end to hatred. And
you say in the book, you say that your experience as a child continues to have an impact on the person that you've become. And then later on you say, I knew that I would never quite liberate myself and that it would forever shape my life. How has your experience in the Holocaust shaped your life?
Well, I first of all, you really cannot have seen what I saw without getting tremendous respect for human life. Strange that I should say put it that way. When you've seen the terrible killings I've seen, and at the same time feel how important human life is, and that we should do everything to protect human life. Why I began to think that, I don't know. But that has been sort of... That was something that came from the camp. And probably also my subsequent work in the human rights area, the feeling that that we have to prevent these things from happening again to others, that what happened to us. And that you cannot be cynical about sometimes the lack of success we have in preventing further genocides, which is sort of the natural tendency would be to say, well, in the 90s you end up with Rwanda and you end up with Bosnia. Some people say, well, nothing we're going to do is going to prevent it. My belief is you have to try to prevent it, regardless of the setbacks that are going to happen. So it has influenced me. I don't want to say that I felt a tremendous urge to work in the human rights field as an obligation. But I got into it probably because I felt that was the one way in which I could contribute. I often thought that if I'd been better in science, I would have become a doctor. So this way I had to become a lawyer.
You did. I mean, you've done work as an adult in connection with the massacre at El Mozote in El Salvador, with other massacres in Honduras, in your work on the court. I'm sure you've dealt at times with some of the genocides. Does this bring back your experience to you each time? You talked about El Mozote in particular.
Yes. I was a member of a three-member UN commission on the Truth Commission for El Salvador, and we had to investigate what happened during their civil war, 11, 12-year-old civil war in El Salvador. And one of the terrible things that happened there was a massacre known as the El Mozote massacre. As we interviewed the only survivor of that massacre, when she started to speak, within about a minute or two, I could have finished her story. It was bringing back what happened that when the liquidation of the ghetto of Kielce, which to me always has been, and some of the other things I've seen, there's sort of the repetition and lack of difference, the cruelty is always the same. We are not very creative, we humans, in our cruelty. It's always the same. You read Solzhenitsyn. It's so similar to what was happening to us. El Mozote was the same. I thought, incidentally, until I got to El Salvador, that nothing I could see would affect me. That was thing I was used to it. But when you see the skeleton of a mother with a baby skeleton in the womb, that's more than I could take.
Elie Wiesel has a nice line in his introduction to your book. He says, when we read accounts of the Holocaust, at first they all seem the same. It's as if, how did he say, he says, yes. It's as if the same tormentor did it 6 million times, which is...
And it's true in other places and other genocides.
I want to ask you two more questions. We're running out of time, and I want people to ask questions. So in about 5 minutes, I'm going to open it up for questions. But there are two quick things I wanted to ask. One is, you write that as late as when you were in college, you could still feel what it felt like to be hungry. You could still remember the pain you felt when you were separated from your parents upon arriving at Auschwitz. But that as the years passed, that those feelings have been dulled. Is that still true? How dull does it get? And did writing the book bring it all back?
No, it's clearly the distance. I don't feel the hunger anymore or the cold that I did. I wrote a story after in college about the death march, and in 1955, I think, 56. When I reread it in order to talk about the death march at the Holocaust Museum, it was as if it was a different person writing the story. It just changed totally. I didn't feel it anymore. The immediacy, and that's probably good. I think if I had kept those feelings through 50 years or more, the detail of the cruelty, the hunger, I would probably be locked up someplace. One has to. Fortunately, we humans can get over it. That made it much easier to write the book, in a sense, because writing the book was reflecting more on how I react to what happened to me at that time, how I react to it now, as a very different person. And I think that's probably all for the good that it happened that way. It would have been a terrible book if I'd written it shortly after the war. First of all, I wouldn't have been able to write it in English, of course, but... So the distance was very valuable, and that's why people often ask me, why did it take you so long to write it? I always knew I was going to write the book, and for 50 years I kept saying I was going to write the book. And it took me 50 years to sit down and actually do it.
There are many, many parts of this book that we haven't had a chance to discuss, and I'm sorry, one of the most delightful, and there are not a lot of delightful parts of the book, but one of the delightful parts is how after the liberation of Sachsenhausen, you were basically picked up as a mascot of the Polish army, and they gave you a little miniature Polish army uniform and a little gun of your own, and you rode around on tanks for a few weeks. It sounded about as much fun as such a thing could be. But I just want to move from my last question.
I should interrupt you for one moment, because I think you would enjoy this. My book came out first in Germany. It was translated. And so when I was interviewed in Germany on German television and every place else, I would say, you know, I actually helped liberate Berlin. Because I actually did help. I was with the Polish and Soviet troops as we entered Berlin. I slept in a Russian tank through the whole thing. But the Germans were totally... sorry.
That's okay. Now, the last question I wanted to ask you, just because it's also a bit uplifting, is about you were, after you left the Polish army, you went to a Jewish orphanage, and you were there for a while, and you were thinking of emigrating to Palestine. As far as you knew, you had no family, survived, and then you were reunited with your mother. And why don't you just tell us quickly how that happened, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Yes. First, I should tell you the strange thing as a child. Here I had seen everything that I had seen. And it never occurred to me that my mother and father could not have survived the war. I just assumed that they had survived. Just no question. Not only that, I assumed that they would find me. So I didn't even look for them. Not that I could have. But it seemed they survived and they would find me. And then through an unbelievable set of circumstances, my mother found me, and, well, should I tell the story about how I was in this Jewish orphanage in Poland, which was run by the Jewish Bund. The Jewish Bund was a left socialist group. They wanted us to become good Polish socialists. But the Bund, the orphanage was infiltrated by the Hashomer Hatzair, a Zionist youth group, Zionist organization. And a counselor one day asked me, "Do you want to go to Palestine?" And I said, "Well, why not? And I've been every place else I could go to Palestine." And no idea. And then she said, "Well, we have a system here. You have to cannot tell anybody, but every few weeks, one of the kids runs away, just around the corner, will be picked up by the, and then eventually ends up in Palestine through." And I was told to run away last because I had been interviewed by Polish newsreels and other things because I was the only one there who'd been in the camp. So she said, "You have to be the last person to run away." But what happened was that my name appeared on the list that she's put together and sent to the Jewish Agency for Palestine. And there, somebody sitting at the desk in either Jerusalem or Tel Aviv saw that the mother and my mother's brother in the United States were looking for me, and a child was on a list in an orphanage.
If people have questions.
Thank you.
There's a man with a microphone there and a question there.
Thank you. My question actually has to do with your role in the International Court of Justice. The United States has to find a way to deal with the prisoners at Guantanamo. And I wondered if you had any ideas of what sort of court of law they could be tried in so that we could once and for all deal with this and get it behind us.
Well, it couldn't be in the International Court of Justice. There would have to be some ad hoc court set up to deal with this if the U.S. and other countries agreed to do that. It could be done in an ad hoc tribunal. The problem is less finding a court to deal with the people than to have law that really applies to them that could be used in a tribunal like that, and it's not all that easy.
I should warn you as we go through the questions that there may be, if people ask questions about contemporary events, and you may run across things that the judge can't talk about because they may possibly come before the court at some point. Okay, who else? There's a gentleman there.
You mentioned how about some children on the death march, and I wondered if you knew how any of the other children managed, I mean, how they were in Auschwitz or survived both initially, when I think you mentioned that generally the Nazis initially killed the children, and how once they were there, they were able to manage to survive the German guards who would have seen them and maybe noticed how young they were.
Yes. Actually, there were most of the children who were in Auschwitz were older than I was. What happened? Some of them came in probably the same way I came into Auschwitz. But there was a German capo, actually a Blockältester, a person in charge of a barrack, political prisoner, I think, who saw the children and saw that they were being hunted down. And he went to the SS and said that he could put them to good work if they would allow him to run a children's barrack in the D camp. And actually, that's what happened. They said, "Okay, you try it." And that's where I eventually ended up when we were collecting garbage and doing other work. There was this children's barrack in the D camp in Birkenau. Most of them were, I was 10 years old, but most of them were 13, 14, or even older.
In Auschwitz, did you meet Muslims?
Oh, yes. I should explain. Muslims were people, and I don't know where the name comes from, people who were so starved from not eating that they were basically eventually just bones and skin and bones. And usually a Muslim, when you saw them, you knew that they wouldn't survive more than a week. And I describe in the book somebody that I knew whom I called uncle, who had been with us in Poland before we ended up in the ghetto, who became a Muslim. It's people who just died of starvation, basically. I mentioned in the book that it was just like watching dead people walk, because that's what they were.
It's been a privilege to listen to you, and
thank you.
I've got two questions. One is, the deprivations of your childhood, have they had a lasting effect on your health? And secondly, how do you cope with the people who deny the Holocaust?
I should tell you, I've been fortunate in terms of the deprivation didn't seem to affect me at all. I claim it's really strange when you think that I starved as a child and now I have to be on a diet. And that part I don't know how to handle. The Holocaust deniers is... I've always had the sense that they're trying to kill us twice. On the one hand, I can't take it very seriously, because I cannot take it very seriously when somebody tells me, as some person said recently, a bishop, that there couldn't have been more than 150,000 people. That was all that died, as if that wasn't enough. But on the other hand, I think we shouldn't overdo it. We know what happened, and it's important to repeat what happened, but not let these people become the center of our attention, because the more we focus on it, the more they're going to be doing it. We should. What impressed me once in Norway was the Bishop of Oslo, when there was skinheads were going to march. The Bishop of Oslo said, "Just turn your back to them as they march past." To me, that is the way you deal with these people. But don't let's overdo it and take it too seriously, because that's what they want.
Well, some years ago, the case of Robert Faurisson came before the World Court, and I believe you recused yourself. Faurisson is a Holocaust denier who was being, I don't know exactly what came before the World Court, but I know that there are laws in France that you may not deny the Holocaust. Do you think a law like that is a reasonable law?
Well, this happened when I was a member of the UN Human Rights Committee, not the court. I really think it depends on the country. I would think in the United States I wouldn't want a law like this, because we do have other ways to all kinds of social pressures to prevent some of these, to deal with it. In some countries, because of the politics of the country, the history of the country, it may be important to have some laws. For example, in Germany, I think it was very useful after the war to have laws that prevented any sort of any glorification of Hitler or other things, because of the way the system, the way the country reacts. So I think it depends. And I'll tell you my experience, personal experience. I was a member of a U.S. government delegation to a meeting of the Helsinki process in Oslo, actually. And my instructions were to make sure that nothing was adopted at that conference that prevented the freedom of expression, whatever it was, could be. And of course, I tried to follow my instructions. That was shortly after the wall came down. And a Yugoslav representative at that same conference came to me and said, you know, it's maybe easy for you in America to take this position, but we are living in a country with all these different ethnic groups. And not, and I just thought, oh, this is just a foolish remark. He just doesn't understand. And of course, then you saw what happened in Bosnia. And so it depends where you are.
Would you mind going down to this woman who's been very patient down here? Sorry. All the way in the corner.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you. What a privilege. And being a Brit born just after the war, married to a German and lived in Germany, I wanted to know if you have children, as we do, and how you feel going forward. Do we have good opportunities to have learned by these bad experiences and to hopefully turn them into good experiences? And thank you again.
Thank you. Well, let me tell you that I've been tremendously impressed how Germany has changed. It's really something that we should admire and appreciate. I've been in Germany quite a lot, and you see the generational changes. The current generation of Germans and the political system, there are skinheads and other things. But the country has learned a tremendous amount, and it gives one faith that it is possible for a country to transform itself as Germany has. For example, I think the best Europeans today are the German young people in Germany. And that is very, very gratifying.
Thank you also. From my heart. Did you ever have the ability to face any of your captors or any of the capos after the war, or had a desire to do so?
The answer is no to both. I really have no desire. I didn't have that opportunity, or, you know, that possibility, and wouldn't have wanted it either. As I said, I was once asked to be a witness. The Justice Department asked me to be a witness in a case, in a trial of where they wanted to deport somebody and take his citizenship away as a guard. And I found that I wasn't there to talk about this man because I didn't know him at the time. But just to go through all of this is not something that I would enjoy. That part I want to leave behind.
Okay.
Okay.
My mother was from a small Czech town that you may know, Mukachevo, mm-hmm. And she was taken to Auschwitz when she was 13, was in Birkenau, and was on the death march also. So I share, not in your experience, but somewhat in your legacy, that she lost her brother, my uncle, both her parents, both my father's parents killed during the war, and he was in a prisoner of war camp. But I still have to ask you a question. What I don't understand is how a people that had experienced such horrific discrimination could establish a secular country that by its very nature discriminates those of not like mind.
I take it you're speaking about Israel, is that? I've sometimes asked myself the same question. I should say this. A lot of what is said is happening in Israel is being said by people who I don't think realize what is happening. It's not always truthful. At the same time, I find it sad that some of the things that are happening in Israel are happening, and that it is by my fellow Jews that are doing that. On the other, some of it also can be understood given the problems that they face in the country. It's not a real situation, but it is sad for me to see. I haven't been in Israel very long. I should tell you, I've done human rights work in many parts of the world, but I've intentionally stayed out of dealing with Israel because I felt I couldn't be objective. I always thought that when I recused myself from the Holocaust denier, I was moved by the same consideration, that I felt I couldn't judge him.
But you participated in the World Court case involving the wall along the Green Line in Israel.
Yes, and I dissented. I was the sole dissenter in that case because I felt, while I felt that parts of the wall were not justified as a matter of self-defense, I thought some others were. And as a matter of fact, the Israeli Supreme Court, and this is something that is not known when we talk about Israel, that the Israeli Supreme Court, using basically my approach to how this issue should have dealt with, has pushed back the wall in quite a number of places. And there are about 100 cases, I'm told, are still pending in the Israeli Supreme Court to deal with this issue. That is not something you would find in many countries in a situation similar to which Israel finds itself. I dissented, and I should tell you, if I may, a funny story about this. My colleagues on the court knew after we discussed it and they had read and heard my position. I said to my colleagues, my wife Peggy and I are just going to be gone from the city once the decision comes out because we have no security, no protection, and the Israelis had brought a bombed-out bus in front of the court. The Arabs, Palestinians were protesting outside, and we thought that was a little dangerous to be around. And so we were ready to leave. As I walked out of the courtroom that late afternoon, my Egyptian colleague on the court said, "Tom, there's no reason for you to leave. You can stay. You're safe." So I said, "Why?" He said, "Oh, I just watched Al Jazeera's television. And they said that the American judge dissented on every point, and then they showed the picture of our Dutch colleague." We went anyway, but...
Another question?
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here, Judge Bergenthal. I'm almost lost for words, but I won't be able to live with myself if I don't say this. It is really a privilege to be in the presence of such a joyous, humble, wise man. I just hope your message just goes on and on and on. And my question for you is, it was said earlier this evening that you were from a family of secular Jews. Is that still the situation? Where are you spiritually after the experiences of your youth?
Well, first of all, I'm glad what you said in the beginning. My wife is here and heard it. I do not believe in a personal God. Some people came out of the camp as great believers, profound believers. I came out the other way. And the more I thought about it, I just cannot. What I saw and what God presumably saw is something that I just didn't want to. I just couldn't get myself to believe in it. And I feel that I'm a great admirer of people who can believe. I think it's wonderful. I wish I could, but I can't.
Okay, we have time for, I'm sorry, we only have time for one more question. This woman here.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience. As the grandchild of Holocaust survivors, I have a question for you just sort of as a global citizen. When we are witnessing genocides around us, when I hear about my grandparents' experience, I say, how could people have seen this and not done anything? As a global citizen, what is it that we can do most effectively to have our voices heard when we see genocides happening around us in the world?
Well, for one thing, we have to hear and other, we have to let our government know and people that they need to act. For example, in Rwanda, we sat there and didn't do anything until it was too late, and we could have done something. There are many instances where other governments and we could do something. And now we have this problem because of September 11, and because of Guantanamo, that it's very difficult for us. Rather, we feel we shouldn't try to intervene in violations, serious violations of human rights. So, and that I think is very bad. We should continue to want to have an impact on what is happening in other countries and not sit by and do nothing. Doesn't mean we should do it on our own. That's sometimes a mistake. But we should play a very important role, as we did in the 40s and 50s, and in other countries, working together with other countries, with people in other countries, with NGOs. A lot of work is being done. And the worst thing is to assume that we can't do anything and that nothing is going to change. There are lots of things happening. For example, I believe that if we'd had the institutions, the human rights institutions now, that we have now, both at the UN and in the regional human rights mechanisms that exist, if that had existed in the 30s, we probably could have prevented what happened. So we need to strengthen these institutions and support governments and people who are pushing for that, and not to give up.
Okay, I'm afraid we're out of time. I don't know whether the judge will be around for a few minutes, possibly. He'll be signing books out back, so if you have a final question, you can probably ask it there. One other thing I wanted to say, to attend the Allowed series is free, but it is not free to put it on, so anyone who would like to help support this very important program can do so afterwards. You can go find Louise and give her your wallet or give her your pocketbook, and she'll be happy to take it. And then you should take a few dollars out so that you can buy Judge Bergenthal's book. And thank you very much for coming. And I just want to thank the judge for coming here. It was really moving. The book is extremely moving, and the whole thing was inspirational, and thank you.
Allowed Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Allowed theme composed by Larry Karish.